It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. When a college sports team makes it to the Final Four in basketball or hockey, it's generally viewed as an honor. But some folks aren't quite sure what to make of Pittsburgh's ascension or descension to the Final Four in America's ugliest accent tournament, brought to you by the website Gawker. The other semifinalists, by the way, are Scranton, Boston, and Providence. Is it a source of pride or a put-down to a segment of our citizenry? I'm joined now in Studio A by University of Pittsburgh linguistics professor Scott Kiesling. Among other books, he is the author of Dude, about American speech. Scott Kiesling, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
Or should I say, dude, great to have you. You can join the conversation whether you have a Pittsburgh accent or not by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email address is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter, at esspgh, hashtag EPLive. Is being in the semifinals of a contest to find America's ugliest regional accent an honor or humiliation? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Scott Kiesling, you say some harm is being done here. How so?
Well, everybody thinks it's just a way of talking, but really when people think of an accent, it's a kind of a person. And often there are issues of power involved in terms of class, sometimes race, but in this case, it's probably mostly class types of things. So you're actually talking about a certain kind of person when you're thinking about who or how they're talking. So and usually that person is not a prestigious person in the case of a local accent. It's very much a kind of a working class or poor person. And so there's a kind of almost a linguistic discrimination going on in this case, I'd say.
And well, is someone prestigious or not? I mean, Dan Rooney's probably the most powerful person in Pittsburgh, and he has a very heavy Pittsburgh accent.
Right. I think Pittsburgh is a little bit different in that you have – a prestige for some of that, but he has a lot of other things behind him and he doesn't have to care. So, you know, if you're in Pittsburgh and you own the Steelers and you have a lot of money, then who cares how you talk? But a lot of people will say, well, you can't talk like that or I'm not going to hire you. So there's certainly lots of discrimination going on in terms of listening to how somebody speaks and then not hiring them because they don't sound intelligent or something like that. So.
But a lot of people in Pittsburgh, and it really seems to transcend all class, economic classes, many people, rich, poor, and in between, have the same accent in this town, don't they?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the same.
Well.
So it varies from.
How you doing? How you doing?
Exactly. And that's very much a stereotype, and it's a particular kind of person that you have in mind when you're talking about that. As you
my
move,
brother,
yeah.
Pretty much.
As you move up the class ladder, you're going to find people have less and less of that. And there may be some places where people use some features of Pittsburgh accent. There's some parts of the Pittsburgh accent that people don't even notice. So if you're sort of doing it, then you're not gonna do those things. The downtown is the one that everybody always does, but there are some that people don't even know, some things that are part of the Pittsburgh accent that people wouldn't even notice. So there's variation in terms, and that is generally in terms of class. It's also in terms of gender, and then race is a whole other sort of orthogonal kind of thing, if I can say orthogonal on the radio.
Why not? You might want to define that, but But it is what you're saying is that it is a it refers to that by judging the accent and saying that it's ugly, it's making a judgment about the people who have that accent in the most pronounced possible way.
Yeah, exactly. So we have like a stereotype of the person who is the most Pittsburghese, sort of, and I use that deliberately, the idea of Pittsburghese, and.
Like Pittsburgh Dad would be the stereotype.
Like Pittsburgh Dad, right.
And we've had on the show.
There are certain aspects of that person in terms of intelligence, in terms of emotionality that people have in mind very often. And they tend to share those ideas across across people who are evaluating the accent. So.
But don't we see him, people like Pittsburgh Dad, who has, you know, who is exemplifying the heavy accent, as an endearing character who really kind of has our best interests at heart when he says, rinse your feet off before you go back into pole.
Right. Well, I think you do that very well. I think we see it that way, but then endearing can also be sort of infantile, sort of treating as more of a child and someone who's not capable. So that then translates to someone who has that accent isn't going to be someone who has the kind of job like mine.
College professor,
right?
So where
you're supposed to talk like me. I could just talk like a Southerner. And
well, where are you from?
I'm from Southern Indiana.
Because I was going to say you're not from. You don't sound like you're from here.
No, I'm from Southern Indiana, which is actually sort of a northern part of Kentucky in terms of a dialect.
Did you have an accent and lose that accent, or were you educated beyond the accent? What happened?
Like many people, I go back and forth. So my dad was actually a college professor too, so I had lots of college professor input, and I heard stuff like that. But I also had plenty of friends who talked like they were from Southern Indiana. So when I go over there, I start talking like I'm from Southern Indiana. People laugh at me because if they know me from here, they think it's funny.
But so what you're saying ultimately is, Scott, that by judging the accent, we're disrespecting the people who have it.
In some ways, yeah. Yeah, because when you're judging an accent, you're judging the speaker.
Mm.
They're all accents are basically they're good language. There's nothing scientifically different from a Pittsburgh, what we think of as the sort of deep Pittsburgh accent and a very proper English accent, or even a very newscaster accent, the way that I'm speaking now perhaps is pretty close. But there's really nothing from a linguistic scientific view that makes them better or worse. It's an aesthetic interpretation, and the aesthetics may be due to, oh, that sounds better or that sounds worse. But what linguists have found is that it tends to have to do with the kinds of people that we have identified stereotypically with the people that speak that way.
How would you describe the Pittsburgh accent?
I love it. I've never met an accent I don't like. I think they're all beautiful and I just get interested in them. But that just floored me because I can't bring it down to one
sure.
word. It's Pittsburgh, you know?
I think I do. And we'll get into some of how this accent evolved. But let's take some calls at 412-246-2002. We're talking with Pitt linguistics professor Scott Kiesling, and we have Chris in Indiana Township. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much. I find this a really fascinating subject because I have a friend who does linguistics studies and actually went around interviewing people, including me, for a book.
Oh.
He suggests teaching some linguistics in earlier grades might help reduce the prejudice, the sort of class prejudice that is involved in prejudice against accents. Kind of a hot topic for me because I grew up in rural Oklahoma around a bunch of people speaking classic Highland Southern accents. Mm-hmm. And moved to a university town, started hanging with professors' kids who spoke highly educated standard English. I had to switch over the way I spoke fairly quickly, because I'd grown up talking more like this.
Well,
so great subject. Thank you so much.
Okay. And well, you had a question, didn't you, Chris?
You know what? I actually have one more quick comment.
I
would suggest there are several fairly distinct Pittsburgh dialects. The sort of Uinsur dialect is more harsh and guttural, and that sort of accent. You've also got that classic, I call it the Mr. Rogers accent, which is very soft.
Mr. Rogers did have a Pittsburgh accent. You're right.
Yeah, he did. And you do run into other people that have that accent. And you'll also catch a lot of people with noticeable Highland Southern accents, usually up from West Virginia recently.
Very interesting. Thank you for the call, Chris. Yeah, he's right about that. That's sort of another aspect. We tend to, people that imitate the accent tend to go hard with it. But there is the kind of softer touch that people like Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers had. And also, you know, Charles Grodin would be another one. And it comes out when they're explaining things to you. Now Johnny, listen carefully now. You know, that kind of thing going on. What about the shades of the Pittsburgh accent?
Well, I don't think they're actually, from my perspective, they're not different. What's going on is some things are still present that are in the Pittsburgh accent, and some things have been removed. So the things that you're doing there is that O from the back, right? So Johnny, and my name's Scott.
right.
And that's something that seems to stick. So I was talking about before, you know, some things people are more aware of and less aware of, and the downtown they're really aware of. So that sort of is one of those first things that you stop using, or you might not even get. That O vowel, the John, is one that sticks around a lot longer, because people don't notice it as much and they don't talk about it and they don't have a way of talking about it. We linguists have lots of ways of talking about it, but, you know, we don't have a lot of words that just carry that. You know, what's nice about the downtown is that there's a word we can just throw that out there, and that's the sound is the sound in downtown, which is what everybody always uses.
Where does the accent come from? What did it evolve from? Which sets of immigrants?
Yeah, well, we guess on that one. But it starts off with the Scots-Irish or Scotch-Irish immigrants. And then it seems like there's a layer on top of that from a lot of the Slavic immigration in the industrialization period. So in a lot of ways, the Pittsburgh accent is similar to everything that's east and west of it, especially west of it. But then there's things like the downtown that is actually unique to Pittsburgh. So it looks like it's this sort of layering of a couple of different things that happened. It's with a sort of Scotch-Irish base, and then this just massive immigration when there was all the industrialization and the heyday of the steel mills and the growth and so many different immigrant languages and also dialects from all over the world sort of just getting thrown together and getting mixed up. And that threw some other things on there as well. And that's probably when like the 1920s is when the downtown started to come
1920s.
Up. Early 20th century. We don't have any, we have some evidence of what the dialect was like before that, and we don't find
out. What would that have been like? What would that have sounded like? How would say downtown in those days? Do we know?
Probably downtown, but I'm maybe more towards downtown. I don't know. I'm not good at late 19th century American English.
But we've established something here. I've certainly learned something, because what you're saying is that the accent that we associate with Pittsburgh isn't even 100 years old.
No. I mean, accents change fairly quickly. You know, the work that's been done in Philadelphia, where it's probably the most studied dialect in the world, shows that it's gone under rapid change over the 20th century, even the last half of the 20th century. And you know, you can tell if somebody sounds old when they talk. Part of what you're hearing is language change going on, but that's true of every dialect too. So you know, the Gone with the Wind southern dialect is actually probably not very accurate either.
Do things like gentrification, do they eliminate accents?
That's a big question. I think to some extent they might, at least in certain places. What seems to be going on in Pittsburgh, and this is some of the work that my colleague Barbara Johnstone is doing, who wrote the book. You should mention it to everybody so they can go read it. Barbara Johnstone, Speaking Pittsburghese.
Speaking Pittsburghese. All right. Yeah. No problem mentioning that. We've had Barbara on the show, and we actually were hoping she could join us today, but she was tied up.
It's a wonderful book about the history of the accent and where it came from. But what she's found is that as Pittsburgh has become less natively Pittsburgh and people notice the accent more, then people talk about it even more. And it's become the thing of T-shirts. So as people are actually saying yins in downtown less, it's something that more and more people know about. So in some ways it is becoming It seems like it's less pronounced, and some of the data that I've done actually suggests that a couple of the ways of speaking are becoming less and less pronounced in the population.
And is that a good thing? I mean, if we all end up, let's say we iron the accents out of everybody, I mean, isn't that going to make the America sort of a more boring place without the regional accents?
Well, I think it's boring. I mean, it depends on how you look at it. If you look at it from the point of view of communicating with each other, then that's a wonderful thing because we will misunderstand each other at least a little bit less. But language is a lot about identity and who you are and being colorful, and so it'll reduce the color a little bit. It might be that we end up having fewer regional kinds of ways of speaking, and it becomes other kinds of things, like what kind of music you like is you speak a different way, or we have very different types, so we have a surfer or something like that, or you know, it becomes differentiated in another way. So I'm just speculating, but in some ways the regional accents are doing pretty well. It looks like some of them are diverging. So the stuff up north, like Erie and Cleveland and Chicago, you know, if people know the Cleveland accent, and that's the one we could make fun of. yes, in Pittsburgh,
it's
actually,
not us. Yeah, it's not us. We can,
but
that's kind of the seems to be the tradition, the purveying attitude.
Yeah, well, that one seems to be becoming more
don't
more
make
and more
fun
different.
Of our accent, but we can make fun of yours.
Exactly.
We're talking with Pitt Linguistics Professor Scott Kiesling, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Sam in Aspinwall. Sam, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. I took a class in undergraduate class at Pitt many years ago from a Dr. Smith. Is he still there?
Dr. Smith?
Yes.
No.
He's on Lost in Space. I'm sorry.
No, it's not the same.
Well, there's a lot of Smiths in the world, but anyway, we do have a Doralyn Smith.
Okay. Well, anyway, more to the point. Anyway, in that class, two of the things I remember learning in that class is called Introduction to the Study of Language.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was that when a culture breaks off from like its parents' culture?
Mm-hmm.
Parent culture, that the dialect of the sub of that culture doesn't evolve as much, so that like Quebecois French is more closer to 17th century French because that's when it was settled. Is that true?
No, I don't believe it. I think some people might believe in it. It's the fact is that it goes in a different direction, so it might actually be more stable for a while in the colony. And you do find some of that, but at the same time, you just find it being coming into contact with other stuff as well and going off in different directions. So
the thing that I remember from the class was that in any kind of culture, the ruling class or the mobile class, their dialect evolves, whereas like the peasant class, their dialect doesn't evolve as much. Is that true?
No, that's exactly opposite. Actually, the working class folks are usually the ones who are leading the language change, and the most upper class don't lead the language change. It's not the most lower class. It's sort of the working class is the group that leads language change in the sense that they do what everyone eventually does first.
Well, Sam, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. We have a little clip that we wanted to play with a woman who is a voice and speech coach. Her name is Andrea Caban, and she explains how to do a Pittsburgh accent. Let's listen to a bit of this.
So let's work on some traits for a general Pittsburgh accent or Pittsburghese. A lot of people think that this is a fictional accent, but my mother's family is all from Pittsburgh, and I'm telling you, I was raised listening to these sounds. So the oral posture for a general Pittsburgh accent, the tongue is pulled back and the tongue tip barely ever touches the roof of the mouth. So sounds like L sounds are very difficult, if not impossible, to make. So words like Steelers and Allegheny become Steelers and Allegheny because the tongue tip never comes up. Steelers, Allegheny. Try that out. The L kind of happens in the back of the mouth, sort of. But you can throw out the word garbage altogether because old school Pittsburghers use the word rubbish. Your classic ow sound goes to an ah, so downtown becomes downtown. That's a classic Pittsburghese, downtown, going downtown. And there's another one, going, oh sound, turns more into a going. Going downtown. So what's the musicality of this accent? There's very little articulation. So what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Give that a shot with that tongue pulled back and the tongue tip never coming up. What am I supposed to do? Look into some actual Pittsburgh speakers and see if you hear the same things I do.
So that's Andrea Caban, by the way, who is a voice and speech coach, in a little video on how to do a Pittsburgh accent. So what about what Andrea is saying there? Is she being a snob?
I don't think so. I think she's just trying to explain how to do it. The only place I would sort of challenge her is it's not a good – there's not a lot of articulation. But I think what she means is they sort of run their words together a lot. People run their words together a lot. And that happens in lots of local dialects, and it's just something that happens in a lot of things that aren't trying to be written speech.
So she's drawing attention to it, in your view, in a polite way as opposed to the contest.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like she's actually saying, well, you might want to try to imitate this. Who knows why. You might want to make fun of it. But it's actually – and she's doing a pretty good job of describing the features of Pittsburgh speech, the main ones that people notice.
It's supposed to be the finest form of flattery is imitation.
Exactly.
So this contest, as I mentioned, which is sponsored by the website Gawker, it is in the Final Four, Pittsburgh, Scranton, Boston, and Providence, all vying to be for the title, if you will, of America's Ugliest Accent. So what happens if Pittsburgh ends up being voted the place that has the ugliest accent? What do we do with that?
I think we ask why people think it's ugly. Is it the accent that people are talking about, or is it their stereotype of Pittsburgh, or a stereotype of Pittsburgh?
Or the slang of Pittsburgh?
Yeah. And I mean, notwithstanding who's voting and why they're voting, but it's still interesting that a lot of people think it's a source of pride that they're the ugliest accent. So I don't know. It's kind of weird to me. I looked at a couple of things, people talking about it, and they were saying, oh, no, we want to win. And I didn't quite get that. So, but, you know, maybe it's a good thing.
We'll see. We've been talking with Scott Kiesling. He is a Pitt linguistics professor. Among his books, he's author of Dude, About American Speech. And Scott, it's been a pleasure visiting with you, talking about the Pittsburgh accent.
It's
Thank
been
you
great
so
talking
much.
To you.
Coming up, Rebecca Harris looks at the business of Halloween candy. That's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.